most of the people stayed away.
That's my favorite night, because tonight is question night. See, last night I give a talk, and tonight everybody asks questions. Except there seems to be this big gap. So, but of course, the rest of you all brought all kinds of questions, right? Yes. Oh, good. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Hi there.
The last person in the room has to ask all the questions. Yes.
These are the people with the questions. Yes.
We were waiting for you. We had a prophecy.
Thanks.
The chosen ones.
No, just the late ones.
So you get the seats down front?
Yeah, it was almost.
You have a question?
I do.
Oh, excellent, man. What's your question?
I would like you to speak more about knowing and being. Particularly, I mean, I've had some very good teachings about that in the last couple of days, but it seems I still get caught in anger, and even when I realize what's going on, it's very hard when you get caught, even if you're aware of the difference. So, if
you want me to talk about it, especially in terms of anger,
yes,
or do you want me to give a general feeling about knowing and being, and what they would mean if you were brushing your teeth in the morning, or
both?
Thank you. Good question. Any other questions? None of the rest of you are questionable. All right? We basically have two talents that we're working with when we're alive. Or presumably when there is consciousness involved with any kind of form. And one of the talents, or one of the ways of relating, has to do with the spaciousness you're in, the space. Is that true?
Yes.
For lack of a more clear description of that would have some kind of relationship to most people, that is often called being. Your being state is the space you're in. Is that good? Mm-hmm. The other quality that we're working with is time. Time has to do with past, present, future, doesn't it?
Yes.
When you're looking at what time it is, it's in relation to, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you're considering the future, it's in relation to. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Space is considered to have really, not really, when you start exploring it, really no boundary. It is interrelating, 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 interrelating. Time is more like lightning. This event, and then the next event, and then the next event. So time has more of a finite quality to it, and space has more of an infinite quality to it. Generally speaking, when we are thinking about things or relating in terms of what happened in the past and what we don't or do want to happen in the future. We're usually caught up with a sense of what we want to get away from or what we want to get toward. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you. So, every teaching that I have met in my many years of being here on this planet basically is talking about a state where time is, okay, just before we go there, time has, however, a quality that space does not have, other than that very clear other than its relativity. The other thing that you can say about time is that gives you the power to name. Because time is in relation to, it's involved with separateness. Until you can be separate from something, you can't name it. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anybody not sure whether that's true? You all got that? You all agree? You're not sure? You want me to say more about it?
I'm still thinking.
Say more about it? And you say more about it too. Okay. So, have you ever, you know, one of my favorite lines, have you ever found yourself in the same relationship one more time, only the name is changed to protect the innocent?
Mm-hmm.
A friend, a work situation, a relationship, a sexual or some such relationship. Have you ever found that?
Mm-hmm.
Once the person is different. And you can do a relationship like that 3, 4, 5, 1,000 times, and then you slowly become conscious of it. Gee, this is just what happened to my last relationship with my neighbor. Or whatever. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about now. Does that help a little? So when you become conscious of it, you can start to name it. When you're involved in it and there is no separateness from it, you don't have any way of actually understanding it or even beginning to be able to perceive it. Does that make it okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is the separateness that allows us to see something. When we cannot differentiate ourselves from a circumstance, we can't begin to start to try to understand it or name it or see how it changes in time. It always feels like the same thing. And there is this tendency to actually believe it is I. Is that good? When you actually have enough experience of something, 3, 4, 5, 10,000, depending on the person, some people are more stupid, it takes them 20, 30, 40,000 times, go through an experience, but then they make good teachers, you know? They're very clear about what they're talking, you know? That when you go through a relationship, that kind of pattern repeating enough times, there starts to be a sense of, wait, this has happened before. That is to say, you're able to look at another time or a future possibility or start to see it with a bit of separateness in it. Is that clear? That differentiation process has to be more interesting to you than running with your pattern before you don't get angry.
Okay.
Because an addiction to actually being able to take it the way you think it will, you know, solve, has to become so clear to you that even if you get it there, everybody else might not find it solved. Does that make sense? That, for example, if I know that if all of you did 12 hours of meditation a day, everything would be much better, two things would happen. You'd all quit coming to classes. Number one. And number two, I would get really frustrated because those of you who continued to come would start lying to me. Is that true?
True.
So even if I get to where I'm going, where you're all saying, yes, I did 12 hours of meditation, it's not going to be satisfactory. Even if I am able to absolutely, with my will, or my charisma, or of course my charming, lovely self, convince you all to do what I think you should do. If you do it, you're either going to be doing it out of one of two reasons, either because you love me or because you're afraid, not because you know for yourself. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
So that is still going to leave me feeling frustrated because I don't have you as a peer. Isn't that true? So you have to get to the point where you really are tired of being the only living person in the universe. Where your plan is not more important than the fact that there are other people there who also have plans. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
I have to get to that point where I have to recall, you know, all those years where I learned how to meditate. Swearing, bitching, complaining, moaning, lying, stealing, thieving. Any trick. I have to pay attention to that and realize that all of the skills I learned in learning how to follow a plan or to get to an end, all the skills were more important than the end. That makes sense?
Yes.
So when I am no longer addicted or intent on, if you prefer that word, getting the end result of what I see in time must be accomplished, mm-hmm. I'm more likely to be interested in how many other ways it could be done. I'm not ever going to feel that way if I'm not feeling that there is some kind of mission I have to do. If I think that my value isn't in my being, but in my knowing, my sense of value is going to be on whether other people agree with me or go along with me, rather than I have a bright idea, what do you think of it? Oh, it doesn't work? Okay, let's being together and see how we can find another one. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it really has to do with not being so, it not being so important for me to be brilliant. And my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche, worked on this one with me for a very long time. I told you some of the stories. I told you about the train station in India, didn't I? You remember that one? Well, it was the first time we went to India with him, which is 1968. I was a really good student. I was going to awaken any moment. I'd done at least three retreats. I was ready. It was only a matter of time, you understand. And I was reading a few books, too, just to fill in, you know, so I'd remember some of those words. And it was one of those small train stations, and he was riding in first class, and we were riding in third class. And we had to change trains to go to this small place where there was this monastery where we were going to meet this teacher that he wanted us to meet. We had to change trains at 3 in the morning. And there were about 4 stations in a row that started with R and had 5 syllables and ended with the same last 3 words, right? 3 letters. And I had actually woke everybody up and got them out from third class with all their luggage at the right station. And I looked up and he was descending from the first class, and I was like so delighted, you know, and I'm going up there because I had got everybody up and they were all had their luggage and we had actually got the right station, and I come up to him and I'm smiling, you know. And he leans forward, he's like, his face is about that far away from my nose, and he says, "What are you going to be brilliant about now, Cicely?" Because I was being brilliant. I wasn't being. If your mind does it, that's wonderful. But you know, what are you going to do with Alzheimer's? Get real. You know? It's like, get real. You're depending on your brilliance. Brilliance is not who you are. That's learned from your past, projected into your future. It's not being in the present and trusting the present. Isn't that true? That was so hard for me. That was so hard for me. Why was it hard for me? Because I didn't want to be who I was. I wanted to be brilliant. Sometimes I could pull brilliant off, you know, if the light was a little bit dim and there weren't too many smart people in the crowd. I could do it quite well for short periods of time, but I was good at one-liners and leaving. But that's not good enough, because in your own heart it doesn't satisfy the fear of being. You have to at some time turn around and feel the state of your being. Why is it you want that to work? It's because underneath the anger is usually fear. Is that true? For most of us, isn't that true? So all the religions and all the teachings I have ever seen basically point to the state of at-one-ment, the state of refuge, as being where the state of knowing is in total embrace of the state of being. Not trying to get beyond it. That's a whole different thing. That's what the tree represents. You've heard me talk about this a lot. You know, the tree is the tree in the center of the universe, space. It's boundless spaciousness and the line that comes down and meets it. The mountain at the center of the universe, the cross in Christianity, you know. Mandala offering, Mount Meru. You know, as many ways as you want to look at it, you have time and space, and it is that point where time and space interconnect. That is neither time nor space, nor not time, nor not space. Where there is knowing being in complete embrace, which is what Yab-Yum figures in the Tibetan tradition represent. Where the knowing is totally in embrace with the being, it's a complete love affair, and then the naming comes from that love. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Was that all right, Laurel? Did I? Yeah. So when you find yourself getting frustrated by where you're trying to go, it's probably because you have a sense of the aim, which is beautiful. But you don't have a sense of relaxing with the being of whoever is all around you too, not just yourself. There's somehow not a sense of confidence about your ability to let go of your aim without losing it and take the whole group with you. Does that seem likely?
Yes.
Of being left out or whatever. Oh no, in India he shouted at me, "What are you going to be right about now?" It was in the middle of a meditation class one time that he told me that brilliance wasn't enough. Brilliance isn't enough for you, says he. books. And just kept touching that one until I actually began to want to see what he was talking about. Because I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. I was too anxiously. Certainly wasn't going to be who I was. I was going to perform somebody. Of course, none of you have ever done that. I understand. Me and Dawn are the only ones who have ever So this is our conversation. But when you're all teaching next week and you meet many people, you might, meet somebody, so it's nice for you to have this information. I think it could happen. But guys, to just relax in where you are. What is it you're going to avoid by having the right answer? What am I going to avoid? Let's go to the big one. Am I going to avoid somebody not appreciating me? I doubt it. You all know there's lots of sides of me that aren't worth appreciation. You've all met them at some time or other. Well, you will if you're around one. Because I'm going to get ill or maybe die. Or lose my power. What power? The only power we have is in the state of being, isn't it? Isn't there always somebody more brilliant than you? Damn. Shoots that one right out of the water, doesn't it? So really, it's like a process of like really not ignoring that you're getting angry, because not ignoring that, but like really paying attention to it and looking at it and saying, geez, I'm getting really angry because they're not seeming to get what I'm trying to say to them or whatever, you know. Am I enjoying this anger? The one thing we always have going for us, my friend, is that we like to have a good time. Now, if you see yourself choosing to be angry and you know you're doing that, there is one part of you will be a little less interested next time, because maybe it'd be more fun not to be angry. And the other thing I would like to say about this is, don't be too anxious to do it right. Have more of a sense that you have every right to be a total asshole, and then from that, learn how to be a good person. Because then in the path to learning, you will have such respect and such interest in other people's learning. You know, anybody who does something really well, they don't have any compassion on somebody who doesn't do it well, do they? Mm-hmm. Do they? I haven't seen that. Is that true? Mm-hmm. So like, appreciate what your own path is. Appreciate it. It's like so wonderful that you get to work with anger, because damn, you're going to have that one aced, aren't you?
I hope so.
Well, of course you are. Because you want to. And because it's not fun. And you don't like it. And getting angry with yourself doesn't help. Okay, almost got that one learned. Almost. It is true that we will do what's the most enjoyable, isn't it? There's one thing you really have going for you. The question is whether you see when you're doing what you don't enjoy. And often when we see ourselves doing what we don't enjoy, in the beginning we just wipe it out because we don't know what to do with that. It takes a lot of confidence before we get to the point where we're willing to see what we did that we didn't enjoy doing. And just look at it without judging it or calling ourselves names or saying, yeah, but it was because they... It was because it was raining, eh? In the rain, I'm always like that. I can't tell you. But none of those things. Just, oh yeah, actually, I didn't enjoy that. I'd like to not do that again. See? Not, I shouldn't have done that. How dramatic. But there's nothing that you're going to learn from that. It's going to go cycling around on that high, low, high, low, high, low. Is that useful? Good question. Thank you. Nobody wants to know the 37 requisites again? Or?
Yes.
Please. Well, now that you brought it up.
You knew there was something else.
We missed it.
Particularly 12 through 17.
Okay, 12. You tell me the first 12 and then I'll go.
One, two, three,
four. The first four are the four foundations of mindfulness. You knew that.
Of course. Of course.
There's probably another question that's more interesting.
No, we were here. I'd like to know.
The 37?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the last time I'm going to throw out a question. Tonight, I hope. So, I don't know how much background you have, Laurel, so I'll give you a little background here. There is this mythology in Buddhism, you know, that myth is actually, it actually means that which speaks without the lips moving. Isn't that beautiful? It's sort of like your heart singing rather than the intellect vibrating. There is this mythology in Buddhism that you can tell when someone is a Buddha because there's no way for somebody who isn't fully awakened to identify somebody who is fully awakened. Because you would be looking with, you know, blurry eyeballs. You wouldn't be sure of the outline. But one of the ways you can tell that somebody is a Buddha is because all of their teaching is involved with what they call the 37 requisites to awakening. So therefore, in classical Buddhist circles, it's always considered interesting for people to know what the 37 are. So in case you're around somebody who seems to be teaching them, you just immediately, oh, maybe they're a Buddha. You know, you see if you want to get their autograph or something. So, you never know, a t-shirt, you know. And so every Buddhas arise about every three kalpas. A kalpa is an inestimable length of time. So that gives you a really good idea, doesn't it? Just makes it, you can set your watch and you're ready. But basically, either depending on who you read, one complete series of a coming into being, passing away of a universe or a multiverse, or three, depending on who you read, which school. Three coming into beings and passing away of a universe or multiverse. And the 37 requisites always involve basically the meeting point between of time and space. Hi, my love. Always represent that meeting point between time and space. And they always start with therefore, all space is considered to be the dancing energy of the four elements, five elements if you count space itself. Space is the coming into being and passing away of all potentiality just before it actually manifests, right? This boundless is called in ancient Indian tradition, the water of all possibility. That lovely phrase, the water of all possibility, the boundless, infinite spaciousness. Time is, okay, given the water of all possibility, this is what I'm going to do. This, that sense of manifesting out of all potentiality, I, and then dissolving I, and then dissolving, and then I. Right? Which is what time is, isn't it? It's event, surrender, event, surrender. You can't look back at another time unless you're in a different time. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
So time has to do with past, present, future. Space has to do with boundless possibility. So the 37 requisites are the description of how you come to understand that meeting point between the two, which then either takes you into greater creation or to the heart of creator. One or the other, depending on which direction you go with it. Anytime you have a question or I haven't said anything clearly enough, please just ask. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
So in the Buddhist tradition, the first four stages of the 37 requisites have to do, first of all, when you realize that you keep getting caught in the same cycles and you start trying to figure out, okay, what is really happening in life? And you realize that if you're lying, stealing, cheating, mugging old ladies, and just generally, you know, lighting your neighbor's house on fire, the neighborhood becomes really difficult for you to live in. And when you want to borrow a cup of sugar, they lock the door and call the police. You know, and there is this real difficulty in life if you're not moral. True? So you start to practice a little more morality. Once you have established some sense of morality, there gets to a point where you realize no matter how good you are, you can never be good enough. Is that true? And it doesn't matter how often you try, there's always something you're missing up. And so then you get to the point where you realize, well, it must be beyond being good or bad. It must be about something else. So each of those is a little leap in your understanding. And then you get to the point and you say, well, what is refuge? What is real? What is true? Is there anything that you could say is reality other than my view of something? Is something real? So that's where the 37 requisites start. Having established a boundary of morality, then you start going. And the first of the four is you turn around and you say, well, first of all, before I can ask what's out there, I have to know who's seeing. Because you've recognized that dogs see differently than you do. Certainly, if not that, you've recognized that when you go for a walk with a dog, the dog's sense of smell brings them a whole Technicolor movie where you're walking in monochrome. And then when they're sleeping, you know, when they're having a snooze, you see them like sniffing and their legs going and then they stop and you know you don't dream like that. So most of you don't dream like that. Is that better? Do you have separate beds? And so then you start saying, well, first of all, if I'm going to ask what's real, I have to find out what I'm looking through. Is that true? But most of us just assume we are real, and we're looking for it out there, but we don't look to see who's looking. Is that true? Like yes. The answer is yes, Cecily.
Yes, Cecily.
Yes. Or I'm going to think about it and I'll get back to you, Cecily. Or, yeah, but you've said that so many times. Why should I answer you, Cecily? Or absolutely not, Cecily. Which one of the above? You can fill in any one you want. If you do it verbally, I'd be happy, but
yes.
It's up to you. Oh, then, thank you. So you start saying, well, what is the body? And there are lots of different ways to explore it, but mostly you try to see, well, what actually do I know about the body? And do I know that is the body, or is that my brain's information about the body? And is the brain's information about the body the brain or the body? This gets very interesting, you see. Generally speaking, when people start doing meditation and they're told to become aware of the body, they think they're supposed to get a right answer. Did any of you do that in this room? Did I see a show of hands? I'm not the only one then. Thank you very much for that. I thought I was the only one. And you're like going there trying to get it right. You're not just interested. Because we're supposed to be accomplishing something in our meditation, right? There's a right answer which I'm supposed to be getting to be a good student. But the right answer is you don't know what the body is. When you actually start to explore what is body, you end up with a verb, not a noun. Mm-hmm. It's a verb. It's moving. Mm-hmm. Every time you think you know what the body is, mm-hmm. It changes. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hunger comes, goes, you know? Breathing in, breathing out. Looking at something, blink. Quite comfortable, itch. What is body? So when you actually pay attention to that, what has happened is your awareness has really deepened. And your mindfulness, the consciousness, has become able to see in more subtle levels. So you're not looking for things to get answers, to go to the next thing. You're actually bringing consciousness into the present space. It is extremely valuable. Then you start understanding more deeply being in the here and now. Then you go to the next of the four foundations of mindfulness, which is you notice that sometimes you like a feeling in the body and sometimes you dislike it. What's that? And sometimes you like a feeling in the body, but the mind dislikes it. And sometimes you dislike a feeling with the mind, but the body... So you like something in the mind, but the body dislikes it. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're really sleepy in meditation and you get a pain and the body goes, oh, 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 and the mind goes, oh, great, I feel more alert. Hmm? And so you start thinking, well, what is feeling? And is feeling in the mind or in the body? Oh, what's the difference? Is there a difference? And again, you're into a verb. And then you take it a little more subtle and you get into what are mind states? Mind states. The description of this in the Satipatthana Sutra is just so beautiful. It says, when the mind state is cloudy, he knows it's a cloudy mind state. Like, yeah. Isn't that brilliant? Not
get the right mind state or have the right answer to a mind state.
Which is the right day? Which is the right weather? Which is the right constellation? Which is the right tree? A friend of mine, I asked her one time to find me a perfect rock.
Never seen her since?
The last five times I saw her, she said, oh, I forgot to bring my rock collection to show you. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because you have to give up time, you see? But you have to do it with your mind that can be aware. Clarity is the same thing as the mind that can name. But when it's naming, it's identifying with the name, whereas when it's you're present in the moment and questioning, it's clarity. That's when brilliance becomes the luminous nature. Nice, huh? But so long as you're like trying to climb somewhere with it, you're not present trying to see who's home. So when you do the mind states, then after you've done all the mind states, you notice certain mind states, there is a greater sense of joy, ease, ability to be present, awareness of more subtle truths. And some mind states, that just closes down. So in the next meditation of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is, what? Body, feeling, mental states, mind objects. You start practicing. Well, if I put my mind on this mental object, what happens to the state? Well, what about this? And you end up, eventually, just by playing in yourself. Everybody who's ever done this without instruction has ended up with the seven factors of enlightenment. That when your mind is just present and clear, that feels really damn good. Because you're not trying to get something, so you're not creating addictive behavior. And when addictive behavior arises, if you've taught yourself to turn around and look at it, when you investigate a mind state, interest already creates a positive mind state. So the most shitty mind state in the world, the most miserable, fucking obnoxious mind state in the world, the minute you turn around and just look at it, the mind state is interest, examining, grapple. And it's transformed. So it's the fourth of the first four. And so once you have that established, you basically know nothing. And when you started, you knew everything. You knew what the right meditation was. You knew who was the best teacher. You knew which school you belonged to. You knew exactly, you know, why you were better than your sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and cousins. And, you know, you had your wardrobe worked out, what you were going to wear, which day, which cushion you needed to sit on. By the time you get to this point, you don't even know if you want a shrine room. You just want to know, well, what's it like right now? Isn't that nice? So then comes the next four, which is then you start playing with that. You notice that when you're sitting there and you're feeling fairly interested and focused now, you trust what body, feeling, mind states and mental objects are. And then you're just sitting and you're focusing on your breath and you watch the mind. There's a tendency, oh, there's an opportunity to get angry. And as soon as you notice that, now you start bringing some energy into it. You say, okay, I'm not going there. And you just cut it off. Or if you're already well engrossed in the anger, because now you know that you are not your mind states. And the anger is like totally present. You say, oh, wait a minute, I don't want to do this. And you drop it. Drop the object, drop it. Just say, no, I don't have time for this right now. Done. And when a positive mind state is open, you explore it. Because the problem with positive mind states is we tend to go to sleep. So when a negative mind state is there, like anger or fear or anything, we can describe it in great glowing detail, can't we? The adrenaline's running. I mean, that's why all those, you know, shoot 'em, kill 'em, hit 'em, whap 'em movies are so good, because it gets the adrenaline going. Everybody's, you really remember that one. They talk about it, you know, but the nice, like, everything's wonderful and fine. Yeah, you went to the movie. Yeah, was it good? I think so. Because you just go. When you're having a good time, you tend to go to sleep. So when a good mind state is there, you make the effort of paying attention to it. The problem is generally we tend to pay more attention, clarity, focusing on what didn't work than on what did. So to balance that, a beautiful exercise is to actually start asking yourself to pay attention, oh, what was the good like? What do you like about something? It's excellent to balance the mind. Makes sense? I love Buddhism, it's so logical. And when your mind is just in a kind of neutral state, create the circumstances that allow a wholesome mind state to arise. Consider how lucky you are to be able to sit there in neutrality, for example. A lot of people can't. A lot of times I can't. So I'm lucky this moment that I can. So those are the next four. You see how they're progressing? This is almost like you're learning how to steer, which way you want to go. First one is you're checking out the vehicle. Okay. Now, I thought it was a tank, but now I find out it's not. Okay, now, and how do I steer? Oh, this is how I steer. And the next four are called the four legs of power, which we talked about on Thursday because that was in the sutra we read, right? The Iddhipada. The power Iddhipada is either path or feet or way of moving. Four ways of power, four legs of power, sometimes translated. And the first one of those is that having established that you know you can create wholesome or unwholesome by your own effort, right? And that the mind, body is not self, nor is not self. Feelings are not self, nor are they not self. Right? Mental states are not self, nor are they not self. And then mental objects are not self, nor are they not self. That is to say, it's all up for play. Everything is a verb. Then, okay, and if I want to go this way, I turn the wheel this way, the four efforts, and if I want to go this way, I turn the wheel this way. So now you can steer. You know what the vehicle is, and now you can steer. Now you say, okay, what's the gas? And what's the brakes? So you say, okay, desire is the gas. Okay, what would I really like right now? What would I really like? Would I really like this? So first one is desire. Second one is investigation. Would I really like this? Is this really what I would like? Would I like it in the summer or in the spring? If it happened, what would it be like for the people around me? Investigation. Third step, energy. Is this a good time for this? Am I ambivalent about this? Would other people come on board with it? Is there the power to bring it through? Okay. And the fourth one, having accomplished it, check the result. Review. Four legs of power. It's such common sense. This is how you awaken. Who knew? You have to read the list before you know. And so then the next five are in two stages. There's the five as they're first introduced, and then the second stage, the same five repeated. But in the first five, they're called faculties, and the second time they appear they're called powers. Because when you're first having got the four legs of power, then you go to five moral faculties. moral meaning, what morality means in Buddhism, meaning confidence. The five ways to have confidence, that is to say, to know that what you're doing is going to work. And first you train yourself in them, and then once you're trained in them, when any one of them comes up, they are all going to be working well, because they have to balance each other. Number one is awareness. And it's always, you know, that clarity that I'm talking, keep going on and on about. That clarity, that ability to just see without judgment. Right? Awareness. Once that awareness is established, then it has to balance the other four. And concentration is one of them. The ability to hold the mind to one point. But you know, if you hold your mind to one point, pretty soon you can get totally sucked into that point and not notice anything around you. So it has to be balanced with what they call at this point energy. That is to say, it has to be balanced with the energy that comes from being aware of the periphery as well. Kind of like when you're doing a meditation on the breath, and first you're taught to focus just on your nose, right? Then after you have that ability to focus just on your nose, then you're asked to hold that focus point, but include in your awareness the awareness of the body. So while you're holding the focus of that central point, you say, breathing in long, he's aware of breathing in long, aware of the body, he breathes in. So there's an awareness, the focus is here, but you're not excluding. So you may be driving down the road and you're aware of your car and all of that, but you're not excluding the traffic lights or the passengers. Or, does that make sense? And it's like training your mind to hold one central focus without losing the awareness of the energy. So it's concentration and energy. They balance each other. The next two that balance each other is devotion and intelligence. Because we love to be devoted. We love to fall in love, don't we? We love to be devoted to something because then it takes all the responsibility off of us. Isn't that true? Or we love to be very skeptical about whether or not we could fall in love because maybe it's stupid to fall in love and I don't want to do anything unsafe. I've been fooled in the past before and I'm watching out for those assholes because they're all out there and they're going to get me and the world is full of them and they're just going to go, you know. I mean, who can you fucking trust? I know.
Can I warn you about cynicism?
You have. So you can see that devotion without intelligence is
fanaticism.
Stupid. Mm-hmm. Intelligence without devotion is
kind of dry.
It never gets anything done. Mm-hmm. And has no power. It's dusty. Yeah, dry. Exactly.
See that again? Those two pairs there.
Devotion and intelligence. And intelligence and devotion, right? They balance each other. Concentration and investigation, like awareness of the, and devotion and intelligence. Those are the four of the five moral faculties. So then you practice being able to have full-on devotion without being stupid, or to have full-on intellectual ability without turning off your heart. So you can totally appreciate somebody's effort and not have to sign up. Nice, huh? Mm-hmm. Nice, huh? So you can be absolutely, completely engrossed in something and not, you know, step on somebody else's toe. Good, huh? Good stuff. And what is it that balances them is awareness, because awareness will always tell you when you're getting a little too engrossed and you're ignoring that. which is how you learn to practice jhana. Jhana is when you develop the concentration deeper and deeper and deeper until you can be totally engrossed. Okay? And you know when you've gotten so engrossed that you're starting to lose track of the outer. And so then what you do when you're practicing jhana is you switch your focus slightly from whatever the outer object is to the inside, the sense of almost tingly light that comes with that engrossment. And you practice being aware of it spreading and becoming stronger through your body. And then that takes the concentration one more level. That's how you get to the stages of what they call jhana, or, you know, refining concentration to its most profound levels, where you get to the point where the consciousness just dissolves into blissfulness without time or space. You know, and that's considered to be one of the ways you develop. You can develop once you have established some kind of ability to focus the mind to some degree. Then there are different ways with meditation you can take it. One of them is with jhana, and that's how you would do that. It's very useful for some people. For other people, it's not a good idea because they just like blissing out anyway. They already got blissing out down. They need to do some blissing in, maybe. So that awareness can always tell you, but there is a tendency, you know, for us to get caught up in like and dislike. Which is why if you find that you're not able to balance the five moral faculties, maybe you might want to go back to explore feeling again. Because maybe you haven't paid enough attention to, well, what is feeling? When I like something, is that me? Does that, you know, is that always useful just because I like it? What happens when I like something? How does my mind, you understand? And then you would come back to the five moral faculties again. So they always feed back and forth to each other. Any one of them that you're having a problem with, you will find the reasons for that problem are in one of the earlier ones. It's such a beautiful setup, you know? And so once you have practiced those five, is this interesting to you?
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Is this interesting? Okay, good. You know how I hate to bore you. So once you get, you practice those five moral faculties until you actually are feeling pretty confident that when you are getting very, very absorbed in something, your awareness is saying a little more awareness of the energy around you, and it just is like that, it's just automatic, then they have become the five moral powers. So this is the first 22 of the 37 requisites. According to the Buddhist teaching, the first 22 are necessary for success in the world or in supramundane. Mm. If you want to be successful in anything, these first 22 will ensure that whatever it is you're endeavoring, you will be able to do by exploring these. Because whatever it is that's catching you up, whatever repetitive pattern, it would be because somewhere one of these 22 you haven't really examined, you're not really clear about. You're not treating things as they are. Nice, huh? Then the next seven are the seven factors of enlightenment. But now by practicing them with full focus. All of these different things appear in different places, but now that is where your focus is. I'm practicing them. What?
I think I might have missed something with these five, concentration, investigation, devotion, intelligence. Are there three more?
Concentration is balanced by investigation.
Devotion is balanced by intelligence.
Right, and the center one is awareness. Awareness.
Awareness.
Is the one that balances the other four. So those are the five moral faculties. When they're fully developed, they become the five moral powers, which is the next five. So when you're developing them, they call them five moral faculties. When you have practiced them so well that as soon as one of them is there, all five of them are operating together as a good Libra should. And then the five moral powers. Then comes the seven factors of enlightenment and then the Eightfold Path. Now you know everything I know. That was easy, wasn't it? I don't know it yet, but I can mouth it off pretty good. Let's learn it together. It is question 90.
Yeah.
No questions, huh? Some questions? He's got that look on his face. The 37 requisites one finds again and again in the Buddhist tradition. When you read the sutras, the teachings that are written down in Buddhism, of purportedly the talks that the Buddha Shakyamuni gave. There are the middle-length sayings, which you know because we're studying that on Thursday nights. And then there's also the long sayings called the Digha Nikaya. Nikaya means sayings, Digha means long. And in the Digha Nikaya, there is this, about two-thirds of the way through it, there's this one sutra where this arahat, this very highly attained disciple of the Buddha dies, and the people come, the monks come to him and ask him what kind of burial, gravestone, what kind of marker would be appropriate. And the Buddha's getting a little old then too, so they're asking not only for this guy but for him too. And the Buddha gives this description of a stupa. And the description he gives is that the stupa is like a reliquary. It's where relics would be put. And it's designed like a mountain and a tree, both at once. It's got some heaps. And then it's got this spire. And the design of it is the first design that the Buddha talked about. It is a very old form, like mounds, earthen mounds, and things have been in most cultures somewhere or other, you find them. And some with spires or markers on top. Our graveyards are an example of that. There had been a sort of a very rough, almost stupa for a long time in the Hindu tradition. And the Buddha said that what you should do for someone like that is that you make the design with the 10 sort of coming in and out steps that are sort of like very, and then a big lip on them, which represents the 10 marks of sila, teaching oneself how to practice morality. And then when you get over that hump, then comes the first step, which is the 4 foundations of mindfulness, each side. Second step, the 4 efforts, the 4 efforts called, you know, like stop, don't go where, if you're an alcoholic, don't go into a bar for a glass of water. If you're already in the bar and you think reaching for a drink, drop it, you know, like the 4 efforts. And then the next 4 is the 4 legs of power. And then the next step, which is the top step, so there's 4 steps. And then there's a ring. The top step is the 4 sides plus the top, which is the 5 moral faculties. And then the ring represents the 5 moral powers. And then the dome represents the 7 factors of enlightenment, which is usually where you have a little cutout and some figure of a Buddha or something in that. And then on top of that, there is usually a little cube above that, a small cube. As the H, one of the points of the cube is the Eightfold Path. And then the spire represents the attainment. And how many rings on the spire represents the attainment? For a Buddha, it's 13. For an Arahat, it's 7. Blah, 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 you know. So if you read this sutra, you'll see it's all written there. In the Digha Nikaya, they give a very full description of how you would make. And in various places, they have this kind of thing. The idea being that somehow just the geometric construction of this will remind the consciousness of the teaching. The teaching is not a written teaching. It is the truth that you know in your own selves. Over and over and over and over again in Buddhism, they say whatever you hear of Dharma is not an outer thing. It has to be true in you or it's not Dharma. So if you are having an argument with the outer teaching and the inner teaching, it's because you have made one of them right and one of them wrong. The one that is always right is the inner. But it's not true for you. It's not Dharma. That's why the Buddha says to be seen for oneself. To be seen, this is the book. This is the book. And you've heard that quote, within this fathom-long body, subject as it is to old age, sickness, and death. Nevertheless, I show you the coming into being and the passing away of the universe. It's like, whatever it is you're looking for, it is here. When you find it here, of course, you see it everywhere. Because you know that if you really are afraid of someone or you hate them and you're out somewhere in a crowd and you've really been working at avoiding them and you're going to turn your head slightly and you're going to see the back of somebody and you're going to swear it's him. Isn't that true? Her. Whoever. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And if you really love somebody, you're going to see signs of them everywhere too, aren't you? Because where there is a passion, there is a perception. Mm-hmm. And when a particular passion creates a perception, if you're in a foul mood, it's too fucking hot today. I wish that sun would just go, why doesn't it rain for 3 years? If you're in a great mood, oh, the rain is so soft, it's so lovely. Why don't you just enjoy the rain? Is this true? So when you're in a, you know, if you are really feeling like things just aren't going your one way and there's one fly on the windshield, your eyes won't let go of that fly. Isn't that right? I can't drive. That fly's driving me crazy. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
It's just wonderful. It's really fun trying to drive between all these mashed up gnats. Isn't that fun? Can you see better of it? Where there is a passion, there is a perception. Where there is a perception, the passion will match it. If you're sort of in a neutral state and something comes up that reminds you of a terrible thing that happened when, you know, your sister took all your ice cream and then threw it in the garbage, you know, or whatever, and then told mom that you already ate yours and hers too. You know, and you just feel life is unfair, you know. If you're just in a neutral state, you'll see something that will remind you of your sister, like a smell of ice cream or something. It will be a sense of imminent unfairness will come through and you'll start seeing, looking for unfairness. Isn't that true? So what do you do with that, you know? What do you do with that? You have to start looking at, well, are my perceptions changing? On some days do I perceive one way and other days another?
Yes.
Absolutely, absolutely yes. 1 minute ago I really liked this, now I don't like it. What is that about? And then not think, oh, it must be something wrong with me, or decide, well, I should like it, therefore I'm going to like it whether I like it or not. But actually start being curious. The process of meditation is looking to see What is unchangeable? What is refuge? If it changes, it's not refuge. Don't cling to it. The one thing you can depend on not changing is change. Whatever comes into being is subject to change. First refuge, impermanence. First refuge, impermanence. As soon as you quit trying to make things unchanging or find something that is totally foolproof, there's already a relief. And you turn around and you look at that relief. There's a freedom. You turn around and you look at that freedom. And you notice that that isn't subject to change. That if you actually let go, there is something that relaxes. Second refuge. Anatta. No fixed identity is refuge. Third refuge. No matter what happens, it's always going to be disappointing. You can be as happy, like and dislike are not where it's at. You can be as happy as one all, and then the next moment will come. True? Mm-hmm. So, dukkha, dissatisfactoriness, has three main qualities, don't you? You remember all this, don't you? Have you ever been to any Dharma classes before? I swear I've taught this several times.
Something looks familiar.
It was impermanent.
Indeed. There are three types of dissatisfactoriness. First is actual pain, which is definitely, as you will all agree, dissatisfactory. Second one is the dissatisfactoriness of when things are lovely. Then they, you know, you finally get your house just right and then they move into the neighborhood. You know that one. Your BMW is fantastic, the paint job is great, it's just exactly the car you wanted and how nice of your parents to give it to you. And then there's a scratch on it. Absolutely perfect evening, wonderful love affair. It was absolutely marvelous. And then it's the next morning. True? You all know what I'm talking about, do you? That even when it actually is absolutely magnificent, which can last for a long time, somebody's going to die. Something's going to wear a hole in it. Things aren't going to go the way you thought they were going to go. Is that true? No matter what. And it's the second part, second aspect of this, what is dissatisfactory. What? Were you going to say something?
No, no, no. Let's scratch right. Yourself.
And the third part of dissatisfactoriness. What?
Getting what you don't want.
Yeah, sort of, but no, that's a different way of looking at it. Not getting what you do want, getting what you don't want, and being separate from what you want. Those are the three ways that Buddha also talks about dissatisfaction. But the actual states of dissatisfactoriness, he defines these three ways. First one is actual physical pain. Second one is dissatisfactoriness, that when everything is perfect, it doesn't last. And the third one is maintenance. Is that, you know, you're always in the middle. in order to have a meal, you have to go shopping, and you know, and then the store is closed, and oh yeah, the green light. Oh, I got to get gas first, and you know, everything is always in this process. You just finish eating, and then you have to have a shit, and then you have a shit, and then you got to do the dishes. You finish doing the dishes, and then somebody makes a peanut butter sandwich, and it's like, just did the dishes. You're always in the middle.
I guess, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I know, I guess. You know. Too real, huh?
So familiar.
Yeah. And that whole quality of like, you know, like, that's what a friend of mine said. He said to me once, I feel like I'm always arriving in the middle. Always when I come in, it's already started before I got there. And it's, when I leave, it's still going on after. And isn't that true, Burt McGinnis? Isn't that true? Isn't that just true? It's like there's this, like everything is always, when are you ever at the total beginning of something or the total end of something? You wake up, your mind is already going on. Mm. So it's like the maintenance quality. So those are the three types of dissatisfactoriness. So the three signs of that you're really seeing things as they are anicca, impermanence, dukkha, dissatisfactoriness, anatta, no inherent self, and then the fourth sign is peace. When you accept that and quit trying to catch up, pay attention to what is, you realize you are not the dissatisfactory. There can be dissatisfaction. It's not you. It isn't personal. That's a big one, isn't it? It's not personal. I don't know. It feels pretty personal for me. I think that's incredible that this guy had the ability to turn around and look directly at dissatisfactoriness rather than trying to do something about it. I mean, isn't that our first impulse? Take a pill or blame somebody else or think, oh, well, I'm not really worthy or whatever, right? Distract ourselves with some kind of like amusement. Have some addiction that we love, or, you know, play Nintendo. Whoops, personal again, sorry. But actually just look and watch the state of dissatisfaction and realize that that is inherent in being. Just inherent in being. So long as there's separateness, there's dissatisfaction. So then the only way to be free of that dissatisfaction is to find what, is there such a thing as an aspect of, is there a state that is not separate? Is there a non-dual state? And that's what Buddhism is on about. That point where time and space intersect. There's neither time nor space, nor not time nor not space. Look at that, I've gone full circle and it's 5 minutes. 5 minutes to go. Of course, I was late, but that's okay, isn't it? Because I talked 10 minutes over last night, so the union won't mind, will they?
You have a contract up on?
Labor laws and all.
Hey, welcome.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
When we talk about space and time coming together, there's no oneness. I mean, is that the same as being awake, totally awakened?
Yeah, that is transcendence. That is transcending duality.
So in the meantime, until I get to that point, there's always going to be the frustration, period of silence.
But you're always also always in that place.
True.
And we have little glimpses of it once in a while, which is why there is this feeling that there must be something else. It isn't that we don't know what transcendence is or what the spiritual experience is. We do know. It is our being.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
with full knowing. We all know that. It's if we trying to remember how it happens, and most of the time we try to make it by out there, changing what's out there. Whether it's our body or our circumstance or anything, we're always trying to change it out there. Maybe if I just had this or did that or did this or did that. And that just is more cause and effect. That's just more following time. Going away from that center point. So when you do the meditation practice from the Buddhist point of view, or prayer, or chanting, or you know, working with color or sound or any of those dance, any of those things, you're turning around and you're looking for who is dancing, who is singing, what is sound, what is body. But you have to do it with your mind, like with real curiosity, your heart mind. You want to care. You don't know who you are. You want to care. Who am I when I'm at home?
Who?
Is that okay?
Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I must say I have a complaint about your questions, almost. I had to make up my own. Speaking to the board about this.
It does come down to loving yourself,
though,
too, doesn't it?
It does so. Mm-hmm. It does so. It goes down to confidence. So sometime or other in the process of any spiritual path, whatever cultural one you take, whatever route, there has to come a point where you meet all your demons and all your fears. But you shouldn't have to meet them before you're ready to. Because those are the reasons why we don't love ourselves. Because there's feeling of shame or wrongness or anger or betrayal, all those things, and you know, lots of fear and you know, inadequacy issues. And you have to be able to, you know, like basically, you know, go in the hero's journey. In order to practice, you have to be a hero. And most people would rather not be a hero. They'd rather be amused. Very few people are really interested in being a hero. But boy, we need heroes right now. We need heroes. If ever there was an age where we needed heroes, it's now. Do you know how hungry people are? Do you know how one word of truth would echo? I'm not saying can't. I'm not saying, you know, another dogma. I'm saying you standing there and being truthful in your own heart. Do you know how that would affect the neighborhood? You don't even have to open your bloody mouth to do that. Or, excuse me, your pristine mouth. Or as my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche said, imagine you're awakened. You're already there. This is it. Everything you ever wanted, this is it. Imagine. Now that would be an arising yoga, wouldn't it? Any other? You've been adequately sufficed then? Okay. You know, it's this extremely beautiful gold light in your heart bones, which are down there just in front of your, you know, where your ribs sort of divide, but just in front of your spine, about that far from you. But there's this little gold room, little globe sitting there. It's got this light going. I can feel it pulse. And it pulses right through your belly, right past dinner and everything. Fills your whole body with gold light. The gold light goes out your head and out your legs, at your arms. Fills this room from all of us. Fills the house, just permeates the walls, moves out through the whole neighborhood. It's Edmonton. Is Ralph in town? We just got Ralph. This moves right through all of Alberta, right through Canada, right through North America, right through the world. Anybody you want to pray for, just imagine them being washed with that light. A little dose to Leslie. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming to you, share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you.
Puja tomorrow, 10:30?
Mm-hmm.